Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Last month, a man smuggled a knife in his shoe through a checkpoint at Dulles International Airport. In New Orleans, a man boarded a plane with a loaded gun. And then there were the seven knives and a stun gun caught almost at the airplane door at O'Hare. With the holiday travel season fast approaching, these security breaches do little to calm the American public's post-September 11th fears. This hour, we'll look at the state of airline insecurity, at what's changed and what still needs to be done. First, the Japanese military provides non-combat support to the war on terrorism. 2 hours from now, three Japanese warships are scheduled to depart from the southern port of Sasebo for the Indian Ocean. There, they'll gather intelligence for the American-led military campaign in Afghanistan. The mission marks the first time since World War II that the Japanese military has operated outside of its own territory. I spoke earlier today to Eileen Prusher, Tokyo Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
Debates here for a while about whether or not Japan can play some role, if not a front role, then perhaps a sort of backup role to the U.S. One thing that the Japanese parliament, the Diet, did last month was to pass a law that would increase the ability of Japan to participate in this. What they've decided to do for today is send so far three maritime ships, self-defense force ships actually, in the direction of where U.S. forces need it. And in fact, this is being done not under the new law, but under the existing Defense Agency Establishment Law. So what we're seeing is an attempt right now to sort of maybe amend some laws, work within the existing framework, not exactly change the pacifist constitution yet. But it seems that in the aftermath of September 11th, everything is possible here now, and people are at least thinking about what used to be the unthinkable.
It certainly seems like it's pushing the envelope on the constitution. What's the level of public support there for Japan's military role in the war on terrorism?
Well, I think it's mixed. On the one hand, people look back to the Gulf War and say that Japan didn't play a role then very much at all and was still sort of studying the issue up until the end of the Gulf War. I think by comparison, there are a lot of people who feel that Japan should play some kind of role in this, but not necessarily to get involved in actual combat. So there's a real sort of push and pull here between those people who think that Japan should be playing a greater role anyway and should have been reassessing its role. That's an opinion that the Bush administration has been encouraging even before President Bush took office with various people in his circle. And then there are people who think that, you know, Japan has done quite well in the past 50-odd years since the end of World War II as a country that doesn't engage in military activity, and perhaps it should stay that way. Its neighbors in the region certainly feel that as well. So it's still quite a difficult issue here.
If public sentiment is so mixed, what's behind Prime Minister Koizumi's readiness to step up with this military support for America?
Well, interestingly enough, Koizumi has always been in the camp of, some people would say it's a somewhat nationalist camp, but not necessarily very right-wing, which has said that Japan should return to being a so-called normal nation. Richard Armitage had said in his report of a year ago that perhaps Japan should play a role vis-a-vis the U.S. that would be more like Britain's.
In particular here, that means projecting military power.
That's true. That's very much true. So this is something that Koizumi has wanted to do all along. And in fact, even though this was on his agenda before September the 11th, it probably would have been stalled before then because he would probably be seen to be agitating in favor of rearming Japan, and that really unnerves many of Japan's neighbors. However, one could very certainly say that September the 11th has sort of propelled the argument that Japan can't sit by idly while a war is going on in the world or where its major allies are attacked. So, in fact, this is something that Koizumi has sort of wanted all along, and this entire situation that we have now has really given strength to his argument that perhaps Japan has to reassess its entire security relationship with the U.S.
Eileen, is there a sense there that this could be a precursor to a formal change in the peace constitution, a step away from it?
There is talk of that. At the same time, speaking to many analysts here, the understanding is that would be a long process. That isn't something that could be done very quickly overnight. So if it were going to happen, it wouldn't necessarily happen in the context of this campaign in Afghanistan. And at the same time, there are a lot of larger questions. Japan has become very used to this kind of security framework. There's no draft. The cost of having a standing military would be much different than it is now. And polls show that quite a lot of Japanese are satisfied with the security establishment as is without having a real military machine. Some people still have bad memories of World War II, and they're not so sure that they really want that to change. So I think those who think that it should change, and that would include Prime Minister Koizumi, would still have something of an uphill battle to actually fully change the Constitution.
You mentioned concern among some of Japan's neighbors, many of whom were brutally occupied in World War II. Traditionally, they've feared a return of Japanese militarism. Have any spoken out since the announcement of this deployment?
I have not heard that they have spoken out. We've certainly heard before September the 11th, countries such as South Korea, China, have expressed real concern about Koizumi's agenda. However, I think it's become more difficult now for countries, especially those friendly to the U.S., and South Korea is certainly one of them, and there are something in the neighborhood of 40,000 troops from the U.S. Parked in South Korea. So it will make it difficult for those countries to be critical of Japan's role in at least supporting the U.S., and so far that's what we're seeing. These ships, for example, playing mostly intelligence roles and not necessarily, or not certainly not thus far, combat roles. So I think countries that are a little bit wary of Japan's role are nonetheless trying to keep a delicate balance between that and showing the U.S. that, in fact, it is on America's and its allies' side in this battle.
Eileen Prusher is Tokyo Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. It's almost 2 months since the cataclysmic September 11th hijackings of four commercial jetliners. The government, American public, and airline industry all agree that air security is a priority. But is it happening? And what still needs to be done? There's an abundance of proposed safety measures, bulletproofing cockpit doors, video surveillance cameras in airplane cabins, arming pilots with handguns, but few changes have actually been made. What will it take for you to feel confident about flying home this Thanksgiving? In your travels since September 11th, what changes have you seen on the ground and in the air? Are the skies safe? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Washington is Stephen Power. He's a reporter for the Washington, D.C. Bureau of the Wall Street Journal and covers the Federal Aviation Administration. Welcome, Stephen Power.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Stephen Power, we're all wondering. We all know what happened on September 11th. We know what a failure that was. Has the response on the security front been equal to the failure of September 11th?
Well, I actually think that the airlines have taken a lot of steps since September 11th, but I think what some of the criticism has been is that a lot of the steps that have been taken have been, in some cases, in some people's view, cosmetic and sort of short-term quick fixes. The FAA and the airlines are both worried about holiday travel, you know, how many people are actually going to show up to fly. And they both have an interest in showing to the public that they are taking concrete action to improve security.
But you quote a 747 retired pilot saying it's a semblance of security that's not real. So what's really
right.
Going on?
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, since September 11th, most of the major airlines have tried to fortify their cockpit doors. Mm-hmm. But most of them have done it mainly by placing crossbars and deadbolts in their doors. What the pilots are worried about is that that's not enough, and that what needs to happen is more is bulletproofing of doors. And our reporting indicated that at first the airlines were waiting for the FAA to give them some guidance on how to better fortify their doors, and the FAA was telling us that they were waiting for the airlines to take the lead. But the people in the airline industry I've talked to now say that they're planning to take action on this, to come up with a uniform standard that will include bulletproofing resistance for doors in the next couple of weeks.
Stephen Power, if you would, take us through the security process as it stands today, as if we're passengers. We come to the airport, we're preparing to get onto a flight. What are we going to see at each step along the way that's old, that's new, that's improved, or yet to be improved? Start with the curb, I guess. Are they taking curb check-in luggage at this point, or is that changed? And take us right on through.
Yeah, shortly after the September 11th attacks, they eliminated curbside check-in, but they brought it back at certain airports. Not certain of all the parameters they've used to decide which airports get to bring back curbside check-in. But basically, when you walk through the airport now, first when you're going, let's say to your gate, depending on which airport you're going to, the lines can be quite long. And you're going to be subject to a lot more extensive searches in, for example, hand wanding. They're doing a lot more of that now.
Well, let's not jump past the ticket counter. Are there changes there? Profiling?
Well, there is this. Yes, there's a system. It's called the CAPS program, and that's an acronym for a computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system. Basically, the way it works is that the airlines maintain certain criteria for trying to determine which passengers might be more likely to be a security risk.
Mm-hmm.
The airlines traditionally have guarded this information very closely. That was actually going on before September 11th. It's been going on for a number of years. The complaint about that program, of course, is that some civil liberties groups and minorities complain that it singles out certain minorities because it tends to look at some of the factors that are known that it looks at are like travel history. So if you fly back and forth to a certain country. So, yeah, when you get to the gate, let's say if you're purchasing your ticket or if you've even already purchased your ticket, there is a screening system in place that tries to identify whether or not you might be a security risk based on some of those criteria.
The man who almost went onto the flight at O'Hare with knives and mace was tagged through the profiling. He wasn't caught at the X-ray machines.
That's correct. It was a pretty big embarrassment, obviously, for United Airlines, for the company that employed that United Airlines employed, that is, to do the screening.
Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta called that incident a security failure of dramatic dimensions. What is happening at the X-ray and metal detector point? We see big lines there, but is there really a change at the point of scrutiny?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, these guys are under the microscope now more than ever, and the reality is that we still have basically the same system in place as we did before September 11th when it comes to those frontline workers that most passengers see. And I think that's why this has gotten so much attention is because they are the frontline workers. They're only one part of the whole security process, but they're the ones that we all see when we go through the system, and we've all seen cases where maybe they didn't seem to be very attentive or they may have even been asleep on the job. But
we're hoping for changes there. We're going to keep walking through this process when we come back from a break. But Jack Beattie, I want to hear you for a moment before we go in here. Have you flown, Jack? Are you ready? Do you feel safe?
Well, I'm not feeling safe listening to this. This is disquieting, and I don't feel too safe when I just see the statistics. Perhaps I've seen it in Steve's piece on turnover of these people who do this really important work of
the screeners.
Manning those. Yeah, I've seen turnover of 100% in some places, and people being paid $2 an hour less than they could get at the little snack bar next door. And they're the first line of defense, the first human line of defense.
We see numbers like $7 an hour and even 300% turnover in some locations.
Yeah,
annually
yeah.
among those screeners.
And so that's not the idea that these people that we can go on like this and that this will be okay with the public really strikes me as a sort of form of economic warfare on the airlines. And if they would only understand correctly that drastic measures need to be taken, their own business is gonna be hurt.
We're talking with Stephen Power of the Wall Street Journal. He covers the FAA. He knows the airport system inside and out. We'll be back to him right after a quick break. We're talking about airline security or insecurity since September 11th. Have you flown since September 11th? Did you feel safe? Did you see a convincing security system at work? Call us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about airline security or insecurity in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Have you flown? Did you feel safe when you did? Have you been putting it off, hoping that security would soon be better? Do you think that it is? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking this hour with Stephen Power. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter who's covered in detail the steps that have and have not been taken yet on airport security. Stephen Power, take us on through this journey. We've gone through the ticket counter. We're at the screening point where the X-ray machines are and the metal detectors. Jack Beatty points out that these are not well-paid staff yet, but what about the machinery there, the equipment, and the process? Give us the nitty-gritty of what's going on there. Has that changed?
Sure. Well, no, to answer your question, it hasn't changed a lot. There's two machines that I think most people are familiar with. There's the magnetometer, which is what you walk through, the thing that gives off...
The metal detector, I guess.
Right. The thing that goes off when you've got change mm-hmm. in your pocket and things like that. And there's also the X-ray machine, which you put your carry-on baggage through. The one problem that's come to light in recent weeks with the X-ray machines is that a lot of these machines tend to register false positives. They can be very sensitive. The way it works is the FAA comes up with settings for individual magnetometers, mm-hmm. and those settings, which basically it's basically setting the sensitivity of the machine. They can depend on just the circuitry in the floor or in the nearby surroundings of the building.
As to whether it catches your belt buckle or a metal pin or a pistol.
Exactly. I mean, if there's another magnetometer nearby, that can affect how sensitive it is. So.
And what about the X-ray machines themselves? The conveyor belts used to move pretty much steadily. Now they stop for each bag. Is that right?
That's correct. That basically the way it used to work is that you would put your bag on and it would go through at a continuous pace. All the baggage just continually moving. And according to one security industry official I spoke to, that would give the screeners who are monitoring the overhead image about 5 to 6 seconds. Now, since the September 11th attack, the FAA has changed it so that the machines stop on every bag, and so that to move the bag along, the worker has to affirmatively, press a button to move the thing through. So naturally, that's just one very basic, mundane, new security rule.
But we still have these incidents of knives, stun gun, mace going through. Is that just screener fatigue? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, these are not easy jobs. I mean,
I'm sure not.
Even though it may seem like a really basic task.
No, I don't think anybody looks at them as inconsequential or easy anymore.
Right, right. Oh, and what most experts recommend is that screeners be seated in front of the screen for only 20 minutes at a time. But some screening employees have complained that they're basically mistreated by their employers or because of employee shortages are forced to stay at their posts longer than they really should, and so they don't get rotated enough. The FAA has been trying to come up with some technology and implement it at more airports that would test their alertness by projecting random images of fictitious weapons that aren't really there, but
to see if they catch them.
Right, to see if they catch them. But the problem has been that there's been just some glitches with the program, and it's not in effect at most airports.
And what about on the airplane itself, Stephen Power? Changes there or not? We have seen some metal strips, as you say, and maybe deadbolts on the cockpit door. Could you knock those down with your shoulder anymore, or are they reinforced so as to avoid that at least?
Well, the bar that I saw today, I was over at the Air Transport Association, which represents the major airlines, and they were showing off some of these bars. I certainly don't think I could knock it through with my shoulder, but the concern that some of the pilots have is that it wouldn't do anything to stop a someone who managed to get a gun aboard the plane, you know, could shoot through the door, or something like that. So,
and Sky Marshals, are they there?
They're there. This is a really interesting thing about the Sky Marshals. I mean, it's really hard to figure out how many of them are in the air because the details of this program are so closely hidden by the federal government for obvious reasons. But if you think about the fact that there are 30,000, at least 30,000 flights a day normally, and those were numbers pre-September 11th, but it still gives you an idea of the volume. Mm-hmm. If you think about how many flights there are a day, and we've talked to security officials and government officials who are familiar with the program who say that this program was only in like the dozens before September 11th, you can get a sense for how hard it's going to be to deploy these marshals in really meaningful numbers. It really is more of a, I don't want to say symbolic step, but they are certainly not on most flights.
Just a floating
threat. It's
hard
to see how they could be.
Mm. Jack Beatty, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta was saying yesterday that the department will now have a zero-tolerance policy for incidents at airports like the O'Hare incident. But do we have the teeth to enforce a zero-tolerance policy?
I don't really know. I mean, it seems to me, so long as it's up to the market to decide that, you know, airport security, you're going to have lowest bidders, you're going to have lowest trained employees. The bill now before Congress, we're not going to go into the tedium of it, but basically there's a stalemate in Congress. The Senate has voted unanimously to federalize these employees, these screeners, the House narrowly not to, but to have the whole thing under federal supervision. And as one looks into that, it was clear that the House Republicans put the pressure on their members, their leadership, because of a lobbyist known to them from these handful of companies, many of them foreign corporations, representing these private screening companies, some of these companies, have already been fined by the federal government for serious derelictions. So you have a situation here where the public, 80% of the public wants this federalized, and this small group of companies, through their lobbying, gets a House of the Congress to say no. You know, for the last decade, American politics has really been torn apart by this one sort of thing. The people want the national interest served. We had two insurgencies in the 90s about this, Ross Perot and then John McCain, both saying the same thing. Serve the nation, not the special interests. And here we have a moment of catastrophic crisis. And again, we see private interests being served and the public interest, 80% wanting this, being put aside by a House of the Congress. This is as much a crisis, I think, in our political system as it is in our air safety system.
Stephen Power, we have a lot of callers who want to join, but let's put that to you for a second first. When security experts look at airline security today, do they think it makes a difference? The Senate wants to federalize all these screeners. The House says no. The President says no. What do security experts say would be better?
I get a division of opinion when I ask that question. I mean, I think what everyone agrees is that what's important is to have uniformity in standards, uniformity in how they're applied. The problem that Mr. Beatty was just outlining is that a lot of the private companies that have been doing the actual screening have had problems with the federal government and with complying with regulations. The biggest airport security company, Argonbright, was fined over $1 million last year for hiring convicted felons at Philadelphia Airport. Mm-hmm. So, and just a lot of these companies have had problems because they're not paid. They're not. The airlines are under a lot of pressure to keep their costs down. So they haven't made a lot of investments in their workforce over time, and they depend a lot on the FAA to buy the equipment for them. So I get a division of opinion when I ask that question. Mm-hmm. But one thing that people do tell me who are in the security industry is that, you know, the system wasn't designed to be 100% foolproof. It was designed to be foolproof enough that it would send a deterrent message to would-be terrorists that if you do try something, you're probably going to get caught.
We're getting the feeling so far that we'd like to be a little closer to 100% than we are right now. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We're talking about airline security and insecurity in the wake of September 11th. Steps have been taken, but there's a lot more that remains to be done. How do you feel about it? Are you ready to pay for greater air security in time, in money? Have you flown? What have you seen when you have flown? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Have you flown?
Yeah, I've flown about a dozen times since the 11th.
What's it look like out there?
Well, it certainly looks like they've staffed up, and there's certainly a presence of more people and more military there at the airports. Mm-hmm. What I notice is people going through the motions and taking more time, but not necessarily having the intuition and perceptive ability. I think it's necessary to spot these folks before it happens. Mm-hmm. I had a specific experience recently where I was flying into Newark, and the guy next to me and myself noticed a bag under our seat that we didn't recognize. We pointed it out to the stewardess. She simply pulled it out and put it up in the overhead without looking at it, without doing anything more than passing it by. Mm-hmm. So it was disconcerting. Mm.
Mark, thanks for your call. Stephen Power, what do you hear? Is there a culture, there must be, that surrounds security consciousness? Is it higher in other countries? And how do we inculcate the American air travel system with a culture of security awareness?
I get the impression just from talking to people and from reading press accounts each day that a lot of Americans are more vigilant now than they've ever been when they travel. I mean, there was a story that I read about passengers now saying that if they did see someone trying to take over their craft, they would immediately storm him and knock him down. I mean, I think that was kind of what the hijackers planned on when they did this, is that there was an element of surprise, and a lot of people just went along thinking that traditionally hijackers just want to get to the destination too.
But Mark is saying that the security staff and airline staff don't appear to have really changed their attitude, even if they've been staffed up. How do you change that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think what the airlines would say is that they are implementing programs to give their workers new training on what to do in the event of an apparent hijacking. I'm actually seeing something different from what the caller is seeing. Mm-hmm. What I am seeing with great frequency is people, I don't want to say panicking, but certainly becoming alarmed at the slightest sign of a problem. We've seen flights that have been evacuated repeatedly in the last couple of weeks when flight attendants have seen a suspicious bag that they thought might contain anthrax or something like that.
So it can go the other way,
white
too.
Substance.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of false alarms.
As the person who has to respond to each one of them and look into them, I'm seeing a lot of that. But
Stephen Power, hang on. I want to bring in another guest right now, Arnold Barnett. He's a leading expert on air safety and a professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Welcome, Arnold Barnett.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. You've given a lot of thought to another aspect we haven't really talked about yet tonight, and that is baggage and the security risks inherent in baggage and how it ought to be treated. What do you see that's going on or not going on that should be going on around baggage?
Well, to put it in some perspective, if in fact there is a strengthening of the cockpit doors and more passengers willing to take action, et cetera, mm-hmm. one might think that events that literally replicate what happened on September 11th are less likely, which may mean the soft underbelly of the plane is the luggage compartment where bombs could destroy the aircraft. There are three things you could do to try to prevent that. You could put the bombs mm-hmm. through explosive detectors. You could have each bag very carefully inspected, and that's not so easy because it's unlikely to be an orange cube going tick-tock, tick-tock. Mm-hmm. Or at a minimum, you can make sure that if a bag is checked and the passenger doesn't board the flight, that the bag does not travel.
So what are those steps are we taking now?
On the overwhelming majority of bags, none of those steps are being taken. And last night, the president of American Airlines, Don Carty, indicated that the system as we know it will not accommodate any of those in the near future.
Is that because of the physical design of airport facilities, or what does he mean?
In terms of the explosive devices, we don't have very many now, and it will take years to put in enough.
The detection devices?
Yes, the explosive mm-hmm. detectors. Mm-hmm. They aren't perfect. Representative Micah of the House Aviation Subcommittee has said, you know, there are certain kinds of explosives that can fool these detectors. Mm-hmm. But in any case, we don't have them right now. As far as the physical searches, that's, of course, extraordinarily labor-intensive
right.
and difficult. There was once an attempt to destroy an El Al plane with a bomb that was built into the frame of the suitcase. It was no wider than wax paper. So it's not just a matter of rummaging through quickly. It's a matter of a very sophisticated hand search if we are dealing with determined and intelligent terrorists.
So what do we do?
I'm sorry. Well, as far as bag match is concerned, this is done universally in Europe. It is done even by airlines like Ryanair, which have are like Southwest, which have 25-minute turnaround times from arrival to departure at the airport.
This means the bag doesn't fly if its owner doesn't fly with it.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's done in Europe. It is universally done there. It is done by some U.S. airlines now. JetBlue in New York has just started it, Sun Country Airline. It's done on all flights in and out of Reagan National Airport. But U.S. airlines, for reasons that I find incomprehensible, are adamantly opposed to adopting positive bag match in the U.S. domestic system, even though they do it, for example, on all international flights, even though we have had several experiments in the domestic system which indicate the disruption of introducing this measure would be minimal.
Arnold Barnett, hang on. I want to take a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Vibhu is on the line. Welcome, Vibhu.
Hi. I have two important points to make.
Please.
First of all, there should be federal employees besides the airline security. But because I have been to, I have done a lot of air travel, and in certain countries, like if you go to Israel or India, I can tell from my experience in India, they frisk you. And these are police cops. They frisk you by hand. Except for your private parts, they frisk you everywhere just to check if you have a weapon in your socks, in your shoes. And they do it three or four times before you board the plane. Even if you go through a security check, your bag has been screened.
Right.
Even if your bag has been screened, what they do is they still ask you to open it.
Mm-hmm.
And before you board the plane, they still do it.
Vibhu, thanks for pointing that out. I want to put that to Stephen Power. Stephen Power, what about a plain old-fashioned frisking? Would it really take that long to frisk everybody coming on if the metal detectors are unreliable?
Would Americans rebel?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wonder. We hear anecdotal stories about people complaining or even resisting when they're being asked to frisk every now and then. I think most people are willing to put up with this for now. But I think the longer term question that we're kind of wrestling with here is how long are people going to endure some of these new security measures, and which ones are they going to get used to, and which ones are they not?
Hmm. Arnold Barnett, what grade are you giving security overall since September 11th? You've watched this for a long time. Are you impressed with the country's response so far or not?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert in every aspect of it. I would say that it is mixed. You know, I was on a plane the other day, mm-hmm. and I had a center seat, and I asked the flight attendant if I could stand up to see if an aisle seat became available. One of them did, and then someone scrambled to stand by to get my center seat. A moment later, over the intercom, they said, "Mr. Barnett, where are you?" Meaning they were monitoring the passengers so closely that if you changed your seat, they were wondering what was going on.
That's pretty close surveillance.
That's pretty close surveillance. I mean, on that flight, I got the sense it was very tight. On most others, I get a very different sense. But, you know, again, they tell us, and with some sincerity, that sometimes what's going on is not only what we see.
Mm-hmm.
But one could argue, tragically, that the risk that U.S. domestic airlines face now is on the order of magnitude of the risk faced by El Al. And not only are we not, perhaps for good reasons, trying to emulate the methods of El Al, but we're not really trying to emulate even the methods of the European carriers that are our natural counterparts.
Arnold Barnett, stick with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back to talk more about airline security. Have you flown since September 11th, or haven't you? If you haven't, what's keeping you grounded? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
Calm.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about air travel security or insecurity. Have you flown since September 11th? Did you feel safe? Did you see a convincing security system at work? We're joined this evening by Stephen Power. He covers the FAA and all things airborne for the Wall Street Journal. And by Arnold Barnett. He's an expert on air safety and professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. We're also joined by a lot of callers who want to get in on the conversation here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jill is on the line. Welcome, Jill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm a frequent flyer, although I haven't flown since the 11th. I have family that has flown, but we have tickets to go to Montana in January. And I'm seriously considering driving because I'm seriously considering how we could create a boycott, sort of like the grape boycott, getting people to stop flying until they pay attention to us. I mean, we're their commodity. We are the airline's means of survival, and we're just supporting them in this nonsense of trying to protect their bottom line still.
It is an uncomfortable position, isn't it, Jack Beatty, to be a passenger and not feel after the 11th that everything in the world is being done, or everything that can be done is being done.
Yes, and some of it seems economically irrational. I mean, it is just irrational for the airlines to say, as Mr. Barnett said, we're not going to do the matching of luggage with passengers because it'll increase the time people have to wait. I mean, that's like saying, no, we're not going to change, and we don't care whether Jill drives or not, or we don't care whether we're boycotted or not. This is so short-sighted. I mean, it's as if these companies, which were not really very successful companies, Warren Buffett said that probably the most disastrous, if the person who invented the airline invented the most losing business ever in the history of American enterprise. These companies weren't well run in the first place, and then after this shock of a lifetime, they are still responding as if it's the same old, same old. I mean, it's no wonder that many of them were heading for bankruptcy anyway.
Stephen Power and Jill, thanks for your call. It's a long drive to Montana, especially in January, but we'll see about that. Stephen Power, you've written that the FAA and the airlines are kind of treating the security issue like a hot potato. You're responsible. No, you're responsible. Where does that stand? Is there that debate still going on?
They're talking, every day and probably even around the clock, mm-hmm. About ways to improve security. There's been what I've found is a certain degree of tension between the FAA officials and the airlines over a perception by the FAA that the airlines still are not putting enough people at the security checkpoints and at the ticket counters mm-hmm. to fully implement all these new security directives. Since September 11th, the FAA has put out 66 new security directives, many of which, most of which, are confidential. But part of the reason that the FAA feels you're seeing some of these long lines is because, in their view, the airlines are not putting enough people at the security checkpoints to carry them out. Mm-hmm. The airlines are saying, we just went through an economic disaster. We're having to lay people off. And their resources are strained. So there is a lot of tension between the two sides.
It looks like there's going to be long lines. Norman Mineta, the transportation secretary, says that patience is a new form of patriotism. We're at 1-800-423-8255 talking about airline security. Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim.
Hi there. Yeah, I flew out to Los Angeles over the weekend and back to Boston taking my 8-year-old daughter, and I had a pretty interesting experience Pardon me?
What did you see?
Well, I felt a difference in the security between Boston and Los Angeles. In Boston, there was a very palpable presence for the security from the airport security, the state police, then the National Guard, which were checking IDs, looking at passports, the screenings, etc., the extra precautions up near the gate, and the actual presence of black uniformed M16 equipped guys walking around checking luggage and looking under seats and things like that.
So you were reassured there. What about L.A.?
I was reassured there. In L.A., it was a different story. It seemed to be that people were less concerned. There was less of a realization, I think, that it's real. People were talking about blowing up the bridges there over the weekend, as their involvement with the whole terrorism.
The governor's warning. Jim, you raised an interesting point, and I thank you for your call. Let me put it to Stephen Power. How big are the differences between different airports in terms of security tightness?
And this is something, that I've also heard a lot since September 11th. And give you an example. After September 11th, when they put out the requirement banning all forms of knives, a lot of air security officials at airports interpreted that to mean nail clippers, mm-hmm. and so people were seeing their nail clippers be confiscated from them. The FAA later clarified that nail clippers did not fall under that, but there are a lot of variations from place to place.
Yeah, I've seen the rifle toting soldiers at some airports and none visible at others. Stephen Power and Arnold Barnett, I want to ask you one thing just real quickly about this almost urban legend now or airborne legend. that passengers should and would gang up on terrorists if they attempted to take over a plane. Have you seen any scenarios worked out on that? Would that actually work? Is there enough room in the aisle for passengers to get there and overwhelm, let's say, four or five, as we saw on September 11th, determined terrorists? Is it practical?
I don't know right off the, you know, it's hard to imagine this. In some ways, it's hard to imagine the terrorists trying to do this again. And yet, one of the things that I know some in the airline industry have said is that, you know, your seat cushion works mm-hmm. not only as a flotation device, but it can make for an effective shield if you're charging someone. So I don't know of a scenario where, you know, it's hard to envision it was hard to envision what happened on September 11th.
Arnold Barnett, have you thought about that at all? I think a lot of people who fly are imagining it when they get on the plane.
Well, I myself would not be effective. I could start giving a lecture and bore the terrorists to death. But I think, though, that Jill made a very, very good point, that the passengers have a great deal of economic power. Mm-hmm. And if they are to use it in to try to encourage the airlines to improve security, this could make a difference. You know, if I may be frank, if you're flying, for example, from New York Kennedy Airport to Seattle, You can fly JetBlue, which does 100% bag match, or you can fly, for example, American, which tells us that even though it does bag match on every single flight from New York to London, it can't do it on any flights from New York to Los Angeles. And I assure you, if my daughter were flying from New York to Seattle, she would be flying on JetBlue.
It's a great point. It sounds like it may be time for us to ask for a rundown on each airline, what they do from every airport. Arnold Barnett, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much.
Arnold Barnett is a leading expert on air safety and a professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. And Stephen Power, thank you very much for coming on and giving us the nitty-gritty lowdown there.
Thanks. Glad to have joined you.
Stephen Power is a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. He covers the Federal Aviation Administration. Jack Beatty, we've heard some reassuring pieces this hour, but overall picture sounds like there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, it does. And it's, you know, one of the criticisms of democracy, it was made by our totalitarian adversaries in the past, is that we just can't get it together, that the whole individualism and individual right-centered nature of our lives, the privatism of our lives, prevents us from pooling together and really coming up to meet a crisis. And as we listen to these things, it sounds like that critique of democracy brought by its enemies is really being acted out here. And it's distressing to think after the most unprecedented human catastrophe in our history that the government, in terms of the Congress getting this bill through, the aviation industry in terms of getting things set and reassuring the public, that this isn't happening or not happening at the pace that will reassure Jill.
Mm. Jack, thanks for your comments, and Jill, good luck on your way to Montana, however you get there. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. About 10 minutes from now, President Bush is scheduled to address the nation. David Gergen has observed four presidents from behind the scenes, serving in the Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton administrations. Last night, he spoke at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston about the men he's worked with and about which of their attributes George W. Bush will need as he tackles the enormous task before him. Here are excerpts from David Gergen's speech.
I was asked to say just a word or two about some of the presidents I'd worked for, and rather than recounting those experiences, I can only wish for George W. Bush that he has the best of the qualities among the men I happen to serve, because I think he'll need all of them now. And Richard Nixon, I think he needs Richard Nixon's sense of strategy. Nixon had a very bright side, he had a very dark side, and ultimately the dark side did him in. But he also had a bright side. And that bright side is what Bush needs to fall back on now. It is a strategic sense. Nixon was one of the few people I've ever met in public life who could go up on top of a mountain and look out over the horizon and see the forces of history unfolding and to think through how to bend or nudge those forces, as he would call them, to nudge history to favor America's security interests. And surely that's what George W. Bush needs now, because this is going to go on long beyond Afghanistan. We need as well the humility that Gerald Ford had We need to be humble enough to realize there are other perspectives in the world about what's happening, what is happening. And if we're going to win the battle of the hearts and minds, we better be willing to listen and listen closely. And that requires a certain humility on our part. Ford had that. One also needs in this job today the qualities of communication that Ronald Reagan had, the capacity to reach others, because we're in this for a long haul, not only in a war of bombs, but a war of words. America now needs to communicate not only here, but we need to do a much more aggressive job in communicating to the rest of the world, and we need Reagan's powers of communication to do that. And frankly, there's going to be needed some qualities from President Clinton. He had a 360-degree range, and he listened to voices all around him, including those voices who had often been left on the margins of life. He listened closely to women. He listened closely to blacks. He listened closely to Hispanics. He listened closely overseas to people in Africa. And that is the sensitivity that we must bring to this, that President Bush will have to bring to this to get through the long haul. Now, President Bush himself brings to this task, to these challenges, both strengths and weaknesses. By character and temperament, he seems well suited for this job. The challenge for him was not the character side, which was the challenge for President Clinton, President Nixon, but rather the qualification side, the experience, the judgment, the informed judgment. And that comes from years of training for the job. And I have to tell you that I think that in the early going, he more than satisfied the hopes of most Americans. He did rise to that challenge. And I think that we can take heart in the fact that George W. Bush has grown in the job. Those of you who remember your Shakespeare will recall the young Prince Hal and Henry IV, raising hell, carousing, chasing women, the madcap prince, and how he leaves behind the pages of Henry IV and is transformed into a different leader, different kind of leader in Henry V. Now, I would not suggest to you that George W. Bush is Henry V. But I think there has been something similar in that transformation. And I certainly would not suggest to you that he has won his Agincourt yet. But he has set sail, and for that we can be grateful. Now, this is going to be a long journey ahead. We all know that, but I don't think we've maybe taken it aboard emotionally. Dwight Eisenhower, when he was president, thought that the spirit of America was best represented from an earlier time, and that we still were there. There were times when they needed to form a wagon train. People needed to call a wagon train. People were called to a wagon train, and they dropped what they were doing, and they joined up in the team, and they got on the wagons, and they set out together. And they went west, up over the Appalachians, and then out across the plains, and then high, high up over the Rockies. And when they got to California, everybody went to the beach. Well, we've set out on another journey now, and we're going to need strong leadership, but we also need strong citizenship from people who are willing to stick together and see this through. We have just started this journey. But one day we'll get there, and then we'll go to the beach.
David Gergen has worked in 4 U.S. presidential administrations. He spoke last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. You can listen to this speech in its entirety on our website by going to wbur.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.